interspaces.
An interdisciplinary podcast. Welcome back to Interspaces, the science podcast of ZIF, a center for interdisciplinary research based at Bielefeld University. I'm Caroline May, and I'm looking forward to today's episode. In this episode, we are covering the topic of random matrix theory, which can be used to get an understanding of complex systems. How this can be applied to various fields is the aim of the research group, The Lush World of Random Matrices. My guests today are three members of this group. Maybe you could introduce yourselves.
Okay, so my name is Valentina Ross. I am a researcher in France. I work for the CNRS, that is the Center for Research of France. And I work, I would say, on the theory of systems which are complex, by which one means systems which are made of very many components, and these components interact with each other in a way that can vary very much depending on the particular component that one is looking at. And therefore, in general, in order to make a model for these systems, one tends to introduce something that we call randomness. And the presence of this huge number of components and these, let's say, varying interactions between them makes the system complex. And what we want to understand is if there is some generic behavior that emerges for this type of systems. So this is what I do.
Okay.
My name is Tobias Galla, and I work at the Institute for Complex Systems and Cross-Disciplinary Physics in Palma de Mallorca. So this is run by a Spanish research organization. And as the name says, my field of work is complex systems and applications of physics in other disciplines, very similar to what Valentina just described. Mm-hmm.
And I'm Jean-Philippe Bouchot, so I'm a statistical physicist, but I became now an asset manager, so I'm using ideas from physics to deal with financial markets, and financial markets are also a very good example of complex systems, and there's been a recent upsurge in the interest in random matrix theory, which is one of the reasons that we all gather here.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So what is a matrix?
I can take that question.
Please.
So matrix is a table of numbers that describes different things. So, for example, coming back to my finance example, you can try to correlate the motion of two stocks, say Apple and IBM or Apple and Tesla, whatever. So you have a list of names on both sides of this table, the same list of names, Apple, IBM, Cisco, and so on. And then for each little square that corresponds to two of these names, you put a number, and this number is the correlation between the two stocks. Do they move together, or they move independently, or do they anti-move together? So if correlation is positive, means that they tend to move together. If they tend to move in different directions randomly, correlation is zero. So that's one example of a matrix. But maybe another example of a matrix that is more, in a sense, intuitive is take the cities in Germany and try to measure how many people go from one city to another in a given year. Mm-hmm. Then you, again, can organize these numbers into a table where the names of the cities arise both on the x-axis and the y-axis, and each little square will contain the number of passengers that went from Hamburg to Berlin in a given year. And so you have this whole information contained in what we call a matrix.
Okay. I understood that, even though I'm not a mathematician.
Well, that was a hope. Before coming in this room, I had thought a little bit about the example.
Okay, and what is a random matrix? What's the difference?
So what one means by randomness, one could say very loosely, is that the entries of this matrix are not, let's say, fixed. So numbers that are there and are the same, let's say, independently of many things, but they are extracted from some distribution. So the number is not fixed, but what you can define is the probability that this entry takes a particular value. So you have what we call an ensemble of matrices, different realizations depending on what is the particular entry that is chosen. And what we try to deduce is if we don't care about the particular effect or what is realized with that particular choice of the matrix, but we know that we can have many copies of this matrix with different entries, but they all come from the same distribution, can we say something about the behavior of this collection of copies, knowing what is the distribution that is underlying?
Maybe Tobias can give a concrete example.
This is an idea, this sort of random matrix idea goes back, in fact, to nuclear physics, a long time, to the 50s and 60s. But a good example is in ecology, maybe, so where you have the concept of a matrix then describes how different types of animal interact. So, for example, a fox interacts with, an eagle. I don't know if eagles eat foxes or not, or foxes eat eagles, but you can imagine there are pairs of animals that eat each other or depend on each other in some way. So now you have a lot of animals, and everybody can, in principle, interact with everybody else. So if you have a large ecosystem of 1,000 different animal species, say, you would have 1,000 times 1,000 coefficients, because everybody can interact with everybody else. So that would be the matrix, what we call the interaction matrix for that system. So if you have 1,000 by 1,000 coefficients, or 1 million coefficients, that's a lot of numbers. And it's basically impossible to study such a system directly. It's very difficult because you have a lot of equations. So what people like Wigner originally in nuclear physics in a different context, and then somebody called Robert May in ecology did, said, well, let's assume we only know the statistics of these coefficients. We only know if they tend to be positive or negative, or how much are they spread? Are they all more or less the same? Are they very spread? And what can we then say about that system? Not depending on the individual coefficients, but about their statistics, about their distribution. So that's sort of the idea behind random matrices in part.
Okay.
And maybe the properties of the system will not depend in details on each value of these numbers, but only on the distribution. So without knowing the values of these numbers individually, you can still say very general things about the system. And that's the strength of this theory, random matrix theory, that is now nearly 100 years old. And, you know, it has developed a set of tools that can be used in various contexts. So ecology, economy, finance, statistical physics, communications. There's a lot of examples where these tools are very useful. So there were tools in the 19th century developed by mathematicians that became extremely useful to do many things, send rockets to the moon or do all sorts of signal communication and so on. And for example, one thing that is well known in mathematics is Fourier transforms. So Fourier transforms were invented in the 19th century and they turned out to be extremely useful for engineers. And in a sense, random matrix theory, at least it's my opinion, is the equivalent of these very generic tools that mathematicians can invent and that become used by even very practical people.
So you're creating a framework that can be used for different disciplines, basically. That's the idea, right?
Exactly.
And how does that work? So if someone wants to use it and says, I have a problem and maybe I can use random matrix theory for that, do you give them a handbook or how does that work?
Well, there are lots of handbooks now.
Okay.
But it's also the idea of this conference here is to mix together people from different disciplines and show them that some tool used in one discipline could be transferred to another discipline. And sometimes people don't realize that what they are trying to deal with is a big random matrix and that somewhere else in the world, someone knows how to do that.
So if you work on problems, you mentioned the ecology, I don't know if it's a problem, but the topic with eagles and foxes, which we know nothing about, but that's beside the point. If you work in these fields, do you need to gain knowledge about ecology or do you just need the numbers or do you teach the ecologists the math, basically?
Well, that's a very complicated question. There's different flavors of people like us, I think. So there's some who work more applied and work with ecologists and with actual numbers and maybe even suggest experiments in, on bacteria or something, which are also ecosystems. And then there's others who are more on the theory side who take their inspiration from problems in ecology, but then focus very much on the theory or the mathematics of these kind of models. But then the knowledge sort of feeds things that are derived in mathematics, sort of initially very abstract, sort of then feed through a chain of sort of you talk to somebody else and that somebody else talks to somebody else and eventually somebody talks to an ecologist and that idea may well sort of trickle through to the end user or a more applied person.
Okay.
Which is what happens in general. Mm-hmm. Some of these tools, in particular in random matrix theory, there's this new tool called free random matrix theory. Mm-hmm. And this originally was invented in the early 90s, so not that long ago. Mm-hmm. But originally, they were extremely abstract objects. And nobody, even the inventor of these objects, didn't think of random matrices first, because he invented that coming from another viewpoint, you know, using mathematics to do something else. And then progressively, he realized, Voiculescu is his name, mm-hmm. he realized that the tools that he was inventing were actually very closely related to random matrix theory, but they were still very abstract. And then progressively, as you said, it trickled down the food chain, and then people realized that they were extremely useful to answer very practical questions. But usually it's not the same people who do the very abstract developments and the people who actually apply it to real systems.
Okay.
And I think the fun is really the path that connects these two extremes, because nowadays you maybe have people that focus on very specific system and they have very clear research questions. I don't know, I studied this particular ecosystem and I want to understand the behavior. And then you have this theory that is very abstract, that looks very far away. And you have somehow to bridge between these two things, and this goes through modeling, essentially. So you have to look at this specific system and then you have to try to understand what are the ingredients that you really need, that you feel are really important for capturing the behavior of the system, and you have to put it into a model. And this means you end up writing maybe some equation that try to describe the dynamics, the time evolution of the system. And once you have the model, you unveil somehow that there are these connections to this more abstract theory that other people develop. And this is a very interesting path, I think, because it really forces you to understand what are the ingredients that are relevant to really capture the behavior of a system. And it gives you also a lot of information on the system itself, starting from a very specific and detailed descriptions up to this more abstract formulation that we aim at. So this is very interesting, I think, this modeling component. Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned something sort of, do you then teach the ecologist mm-hmm. the maths or something? So I don't think that captures the interaction how it is. Mm-hmm. So, well, I'll give an example from biology. So I've talked a lot to biologists and worked with biologists, so systems biologists. And it's, so if you try to teach the maths, this is somehow this will eventually fail. So it's more like you talk to somebody and they mention their particular problem. So they say, I have this genetic circuit and there's this protein and this is happening, right? And this messenger RNA, whatever. And they talk to you for a while. And you sort of, as a physicist, you don't really understand what they're saying, right? So you partly understand. But in your mind, you're starting to make a model. You say, I'm sort of have some equations in my mind that I could maybe write down. And then you start asking them questions. You say, you mentioned that thing there. Is that really important? Or that thing, does that interact positively or negatively with the other thing? And then they say, interact positively? What do you mean by that? Or then you say, is this process fast or slow compared to this other thing? You ask questions like this. And they sort of go, oh, wow, we never thought about this like this. We would never ask these questions. So in that sense, that making the model, and this is sort of what a physicist is trained to do, it sort of makes your thinking more precise about the particular phenomenon that you're looking at. And it's not always a question of, I want to predict exactly what will happen tomorrow. So I see models, it's more as a tool for thinking, really, to make your thinking precise and the questions that you ask more mm-hmm. precise than they would be otherwise. That's at least in my experience. That's
mm-hmm. No, that's true. And you know, about the food chain I was speaking about earlier, scientists, they have different skills. Some can be very good at experiments, but don't really handle the math. So it's no real use to teach them the math. They won't do much with that. What's important is the network, the interaction between these scientists, the collaboration between them. That's how new science usually, it's not a single person, or very rarely a single person who does both the experiment and the theory and the math. It comes from aggregation of knowledge between different people. And that's why also we're very thankful to ZIF to be here this week, because it's a way to communicate and to foster such collaborations.
Yeah, we're really happy to have you. And it sounds really interesting. And it sounds also like you are benefiting a lot from being at the same place and having the space to talk to each other and asking the right questions, if I understood that correctly. So what are other challenges that you are facing? Did you notice anything when it comes to working between different disciplines or combining them?
So you have to establish communication, as I sort of mentioned. And so it doesn't help physicists sort of being arrogant about it and say, you ecologists or you biologists, you don't even know the most simple equations. And I've been in conversations like this, so that doesn't help. But then not all economists, for example, are open to influence from physics. I mean, Jean-Philippe can talk about this more. And so you need to find people in the respective other field, in the non-mathematical or less mathematical field, or the more applied field, that are willing to engage with you. And then it's a sort of iterative problem. You sort of go through cycles. You at some point you start working on a manuscript, and both sides edit it and try to make it suitable for their communities. And in that process, you learn a lot about the respective other side, I think.
Yeah, interdisciplinary science is difficult because of language first. Mm-hmm. People speak different languages, use different tools, and sometimes they call the same thing with different names. So, you know, you have to learn to speak to one another. But beyond language, I think the most striking to me, at least when I try to interact with economists, as has been mentioned, is that we don't even find the same things interesting. I mean, some of the things that I find extremely interesting, economists think that they are not interesting, and vice versa. And so it's not even a question of language. It's a question of agreeing on what is interesting and what is not. And this is sometimes a huge hurdle that cannot be resolved. And sometimes, you know, we just go in parallel because, you know, there's no common interest in the end. And that can be very frustrating and humbling at the same time.
Yeah, that I can get that. What do you hope to achieve at the end of the workshop, or even at the end of the research group, which goes on until the end of the year, I believe? So what's the goal?
I think it's mostly, so we gather together people that work possibly on different things with the aim of having a common language, as we said. So I think the main goal would be that these people talk together. So this is not necessarily something that happens with all people all together, but maybe pairs or group of people. They discuss, they exchange, they tell to each other what they have been working on, what are the problems that are open that they think they are interesting, and then maybe somebody else comes with an input, or I saw something similar in this other problem that I've been solving, maybe we can join forces and help each other to, let's say, advance in a particular research direction. So I would say this is the main goal.
Yes, initiate collaborations.
Mm-hmm. How do you know which people or which groups to pair together? Because you said sometimes people find different things interesting, and sometimes there's just this parallel of, okay, this is what I think is interesting here, and you don't really find common ground. So how do you make sure that...
You mean for this workshop?
For example, for this one, yeah.
Well,
it's a spontaneous... we don't make sure. We put people together. Okay. Each person has a chance to tell to the other what mm-hmm. they have been working on recently, for example. And then people listen and they get ideas mm-hmm. and they go to talk to the person who has spoken. And this is very spontaneous.
Okay.
Yes, but we've chosen them because there would be a priori mm-hmm. a chance that they can talk to each other.
Okay, and then you hope for the best.
Yeah.
Which usually works.
Yeah. I mean, they are here because they want to find
also,
out
yeah.
new things. So
yes.
I would hope they do have an open mind.
Yes, and actually I heard this morning that someone whom we invited decided not to come because it was too much physics. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's a selection bias, and people who agree to come here, also people who believe that they can interact and get something out of the meeting.
Yeah.
Sometimes you don't know immediately. So at the end of this program, or well, there will be benefits, sort of long-term benefits that you don't know immediately. So I frequently find myself reading something somewhere and they say, in 2014, I went to this conference and there was this guy giving a talk about something and this may have to do with what I'm thinking about now. So let me look up what that person, you know, talked about at the time or maybe wrote somewhere in a paper. You sort of have vague associations of things that might be useful. And you collect that information by going to meetings like this.
What I find also interesting when building these groups is to try to aim at, let's say, career stage diversity. So there are some people that are earlier in their career path and some people that are more advanced in their career path. And it's very good to mix them together because usually people have a tendency to interact with, say, similars. And these are very good situations where you mix people, and this is very fruitful, I think.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, that's true. So I remember when I was a student or a postdoc, and you read a lot of papers, but you have not met the people. And then you go to a meeting and say, ah, this is Jean-Philippe Pouchot. Finally, I see him for the first time, right? Because I had seen his paper or read his papers. And this is sort of what happens, I guess, to the younger people. So the three of us met on numerous occasions. But I think for the students, it is good to meet or to see the more senior people also.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot
and
of
networking. And vice versa.
Well,
and vice versa.
Yes, that's yes. Awesome. Yes that's
because
true.
You get a lot of input from, let's say,
also.
The younger people.
Okay. So I hear a lot of languages spoken in the corridors, a lot of European languages. Is it a European research topic or is that just my impression?
I would say that it's true that there's a lot of Europeans in that field. Some of these Europeans are actually in the US, but for different reasons. But there's a strong group in Japan, for example, that has contributed a lot. So it's more difficult for them to come, I guess. So, but I would say that it is true that it is traditionally a rather European subject, although there are many groups in the US, of course, because the US is huge and has a strong, but I don't know, I probably was created there. And I think that, at least in France, there's been a very strong tradition, long tradition on random matrix theory. And one of the reasons is that mathematics in France is very strong. And so even physics tends to be drawn towards more mathematical issues. And so I think there's a tradition of that found that random matrix theory was really at the border between mathematics and physics, and it attracted people there. But this is just a very idiosyncratic interpretation of what happened in France. Maybe in the rest of Europe it just spread out, I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah, sometimes there's individual people. I mean, so Italy is very strong in this area, and this is, I don't know, due to Giorgio Parisi in no small measure, I would say, Nobel laureate, and who sort of, I don't know I was going to say the center of gravity of the group in Rome, but I'm not quite sure if that's accurate. But
well, there's a strong activity in Germany too.
But sometimes it's individual cities, even, right? So Paris, Rome, I don't know, here. Yeah.
But it is true that the more you realize that these tools can be applied to understand different sets of problems, then this very naturally, I think, enlarges the basin of the people that become interesting. So I think this is a process that is ongoing.
I do like that we have something that US hasn't taken yet. But I'm sure they also will catch on. What else?
Maybe we could dive somewhat deeper in a certain example to understand what does it mean to understand a complex system. So you mentioned it's not always about manipulation, it's not always about forecasting. So what does it mean to understand a complex system? Is that what you want to achieve, that you can manipulate a system? I don't know, maybe you have proteins and you have ligands in the cell and you want to somehow to, I don't know, design a new protein or so. Would it help in such a case? Or is it more about forecasting? I mean, maybe it's also very different if you talk about biology or finance or whatever.
Maybe you can talk about Robert May's paradigm.
Yeah,
right?
If we go back to that model, so sometimes it's more about sort of what elements of a system, what structures produce a certain effect. So I go back to the example of ecology in the 70s, Robert May. So he used random matrices to model or to try to say something about whether an ecosystem or a complex system more generally might be stable or not. And what he found is, based on sort of random matrix considerations, that a system tends to be unstable when it is either large or very heterogeneous, or both. So he developed a criterion, some quantity, and said if this quantity is sufficiently large, then this tends to be unstable. And that would be a prediction. Do we say, okay, larger ecosystems or larger complex systems should be unstable? And then you can ask yourself, this was based on some assumptions that he made, is that actually what one sees in nature or not? And this, for example, there immediately doubts developed because they are large and heterogeneous stable systems. And then you can conclude, well, the assumptions that he made in his model are maybe not quite accurate. So there must be something else. And in fact, he then asked the questions, well, how does nature then do it? If it's not like this with a simple random model like this, there must be some other structure that we don't know about, but it tells you where to look, for example. That's one example.
Yeah, go ahead.
And no, I just want to comment, maybe this stability question is very natural and also important to ask. So suppose I have an ecosystem. The ecosystem is not equal to itself, or the condition in which the ecosystem exists are not equal over time. So there may be fluctuations of the environment where you place the ecosystem, or even fluctuation in the population itself. So I can have that the rabbits reproduce with some rate constantly, and then suddenly I have a little bit more rabbits than the year before. And you have to ask, this increase in the number of rabbits, what is the effect that it has on the ecosystem as a whole? So does the ecosystem react very strongly to this fluctuation? So it really changes completely its state. So I increase the number of rabbits, and the number of, I don't know, fox rapidly increases as well. And so at the end of this process, I have an ecosystem that is completely different from the previous one. Or is it stable in the sense that this fluctuation doesn't really modify the situation with respect to what I had before these fluctuations? Or I consider immigration. So there is a species that was not there, which suddenly comes into the ecosystem. What is the effect? How does the system react? This is a very general question that I think applies, of course, not only to ecological systems, but also it's very natural to ask in finance, in problems of physics as well.
Yes, so maybe I can add something, which is that for complex systems, usually it's very difficult to make any prediction at all anyway. So what is interesting to understand are scenarios. You know, what can happen? What is the global picture? What makes sense? And so, for example, in ecology, is it true that larger heterogeneous systems are unstable or not? These are not very precise predictions. They are kind of global statements, qualitative statements about what can happen. And random matrix theory is a way to try to discipline these questions. So there's a lot of these examples where one tries to have qualitative answers before diving into more precise predictions, because it's important to know whether we understand the basics of a system or not. If we don't understand the basics of a system, then it's no use going into more precise predictions. So, for example, you know, if we predict that large ecosystems should be unstable and they are not, then we're on the wrong path and we should take a turn back and change the assumptions and so on. And so it's a progressive process onto building something that can be used in practice. But in other cases, random matrix theory can already be applied to answer very precise questions that are of practical interest. So coming back to my examples earlier on of what is a matrix, then often these matrices, they have a lot of measurement noise in them. So for example, in the example of measuring the number of people who travel from Hamburg to Berlin, well then, you know, this year you won't count exactly the same number as next year or the year before. So there's intrinsic noise, as we call it, measurement noise. That is, you know, maybe you make errors in measurement. Maybe there's intrinsic fluctuations that make the system not the same every time you look at it. And so you have a big table of numbers, and each of these numbers is soiled by noise, by randomness, by errors. So can you clean your matrix? Can you use some tools to, even if you measured the wrong things, to kind of self-correct what you measure? And surprisingly, random matrix theory is a way to, which is, you know, maybe a little miraculous, but allows you to do this. That is, you look at your big matrix, and there are tools to help you clean out some of the measurement noise that is inherently in the process of measuring. So that's a precise example where random matrix theory is not a kind of metaphorical vision of the world like May, but it's actually an engineering tool to get more precise measurements out of a big table of numbers.
Mm-hmm. How do you know?
Does that make sense?
Yeah, but how do you know if the system you're observing or the model you've created is wrong? Like you said, if you think that a system is stable but it isn't, how do you find out? Is there a way, or is it?
Well, this work by May that I mentioned created a whole debate. It's called the complexity stability debate. So this question is basically still being discussed, right? So what is it then that creates stability? Yeah. And then you say, okay, well, what if I make these changes to the model, and then that other change and that change? Which one of these makes it more stable? And then you can maybe get an idea of what features you might look for in real ecosystems, for example. I would say. I wanted to say, so one thing that occurred to me, maybe is useful for the listeners, when we talk about randomness, so if you live in a Newtonian world, so Newton's physics, you think of the motion of planets and stars and things, there's nothing random in there really. So we can predict when the next solar eclipse happens to an amazing accuracy. So why then do we do random models? And the example that I always use to explain this is modeling of the pandemic or the epidemic. So these models that were used to model the spread of diseases, they sort of go sort of like you have two people in a room or in contact, and then you say there's a certain probability that one catches the disease from the other. So suppose one of them is infected, the other one is not, and you say they meet, and then there's a probability so-and-so that the other person will be infected. And you, when you simulate this in the model, you really flip a coin, a biased coin, right? And you make this other person infected or not. So, but this is, of course, not how the real world works. So in reality, if you now were to model the exact lung, the shapes of the lungs of these two people, you have a very, very detailed model, and of the virus particles diffusing in the air or something, you could sort of predict whether that other person infects the other person or not, right? But you say, well, I don't want to care about that level of detail. This is not what I want to model. I want to make a larger scale model, and I effectively treat this as random. So I don't worry about these details underneath. Because otherwise, you have to go even deeper, right? And you have to model individual atoms and then elementary particles within the atoms. And where do you stop? You're never going to get anywhere. So you have to draw a line and say, everything below that, I treat it as effective randomness. And I think this is sort of the general idea in this wider area.
Yeah, which dates back from the early 20th century. I mean, this idea that, you know, what people call Brownian motion, that is, you put a somewhat big particle, micron scale, in the water, and you see that this particle is moving all the time, and you ask why, and people at some point thought maybe there's life, but of course these particles are completely inert, they're not life. But the reason they move all the time is because the molecules of water are hitting permanently this big blob that you've put in there. And the random, coming back to what Tobias just said, you can try to model this exchange of momentum, these forces, by describing all the atoms of water individually, but this is hopeless. So in 1907, I think, Langevin decided that, or before him, Einstein, but Langevin really formalized this idea into replacing a lot of unknown and impossible to know individual motion of atoms by something random, something that is effectively random. And this goes under the name of the Langevin equation.
Okay.
Which is the mother of what we're doing here.
And interestingly, that same model, or a very similar model, was then later used to model stock markets or markets.
Actually, before.
Well, but 1900. Okay, so you go Bachelier. Okay, well. But they said there's a Nobel Prize for the Black-Scholes formula, which essentially is a model of price movements on a market that uses a very similar mathematical model, and that is meant to reflect the total effect of what all these different traders do. And you say, well, but I'm not going to, that model doesn't operate at the level of traders, but just sort of aggregates that and says prices follow a random motion that is similar to Brownian motion.
So we have the habit of replacing everything we don't know by something effectively random.
Well, but it is very successful.
Oh, yes.
So,
yes.
So it works.
Yes, yes.
this is sort of, one can talk endlessly about this, right? There's this sort of this approach of reductionism that people thought initially that you have to look at a system, then so what particles is this made of, and what you go deeper and deeper and smaller length scales and so on, right? And then you reach elementary particles, and then some people would claim if you want to model the stock market, you have to start with
quarks.
With quarks, yeah, exactly, right? But this is of course hopeless.
Yes.
So you have to start at some level and say this is my starting point, and this is what I model, and I try to be as sensible as I can about the stuff that is below that I don't know about.
So how do you decide about the right scale?
And how do you know you're wrong, which was one of the questions. I think, of course, we discussed a lot the beauty of modeling. So once you have a specific system, you try to abstract and you try to get the main ingredients out of them. But of course, you can be wrong. You can maybe forget something. And in front of you, you have reality. So you have the model and you have reality, and it's a constant conversation between the two. And sometimes maybe you tend to get affectionate to some model, but then reality tells you this is not enough, because the scenarios that are predicted by this model, you don't see them when you look at a concrete ecosystem or at your physical systems or at data from the stock market. And so you have to adapt a little bit. And this is, I would say, really a conversation between you modeling and the truth that comes from the reality of the system that you want to model. And this is also very nice. Mm. It's part of the game.
I think it also depends on the purpose. Going back to this epidemics example, so there, physicists tend to work on very simple models, you know, with very abstract models of epidemic spread of the kind that I mentioned. But then when in 2020, people really wanted to know, okay, how many COVID cases are we going to have? And the model that was used by the British government, for example, at some point I read through the documentation, is of course extremely detailed, right? There are households in different cities and people commuting between cities, a lot of detail in there, because the purpose there was to provide the best advice possible for this concrete case to the government. Whereas if a physicist looks at a more simple model, they want to understand sort of on a more abstract level what the different effects are that are in play there. And these are different purposes, I would say.
But again, if you don't understand the phenomenon, it's useless to think that your model is going to be able to predict more detailed things. And I think that's really important. For example, in economics, there are really models that are used to predict next year's inflation. But when you look at the models, they are not able to describe what goes on in reality, even at the qualitative level. So it looks completely preposterous to think that a model that's not able to explain, you know, the coarse things, the coarse phenomena, are able to predict detailed numbers about inflation. So I think it's important to understand as much as possible how much we can explain with simple models first before extending them to more complex models. And so I think, again, coming back to random matrix theory, this is really the point of this field, is how much can we explain with minimal assumptions? And then if it doesn't work, then we know that the assumptions need to be enriched. But the first step, which is to know, okay, what do we see if we just make the simplest assumptions of all? And already it can be extremely complicated. So for example, water molecules, the very same water molecules, if you change temperature, there can be ice and there can be water, I mean, liquid water. And for a long time, people didn't understand that because it looks so different. You know, ice, you can sit on it, and water, you can drink it. And so the first idea that comes to mind is that the fundamental objects that create water must be different somehow individually, that the H2O molecules, maybe they change shape or they become bigger or smaller, or the angles between H molecule, the H atoms change or whatever. But it's not true. Statistical physics allows you to understand how ice can become water with the very same object at the microscopic level. So it's a kind of Occam's razor that, you know, if you can get as much as you can using the simplest assumptions, then that's what you should start doing before thinking about more detailed models.
Okay, so we can't predict the next inflation, but where can we apply it in economics? Are there topics that are...
Oh, random matrix theory? Mm-hmm. Yeah, as I said, for example, one of the big issue in economics or finance is that there's a lot of variables that interact. So I don't know, for example, inflation, production in many sectors, how do they predict next year's stock market in subsectors, markets around the world? So there's a lot of things that you can observe and a lot of things that you want to predict. And so between these two, there's a matrix. The big table of numbers, it allows you to transfer inputs into outputs. Mm-hmm. And so you have to measure this big matrix. But of course, as I said earlier, this big matrix is going to be soiled by a lot of measurement noise because there's not enough data, because the world is non-stationary. You know, can you use the data from the 1920s in 2020? Not sure. So there's a lot of real issues in measurement. And random matrix theory allows you to somehow make a step in cleaning these matrices, making them more precise, even if you think you don't have enough data to measure them. So that's a very practical tool.
How is it related to big data? So nowadays there's a big hype about forgetting about explanations and only concentrating on analysis of big data.
Yes, exactly. No, random matrix theory is making a big push into big data and machine learning also. For some slightly different reasons, but in neural networks, the tools that people are using to create these large language models, or there's a lot of hidden matrices everywhere. And there's a big explosion of the use of random matrix theory also in machine learning. That was the theme of the first workshop in September here.
One critique is always that when you apply this analysis of big data, you don't have an explanation. But you mentioned that you cannot go without this explanation. So how is big data and explanation connected in your theory?
Yeah, random matrix theory is also a tool to extract elements that allow you to understand. As I was trying to explain, a big matrix is a transfer from inputs to outputs, from data to effects. But if you look at these big matrices, they are tools to understand what is important in the data. And so if you can extract the important features in the data, then you start having an explanation of maybe why it works or...
So I think that what you are alluding to is this. So there's a paper, the End of Theory, I think it's from 2008 roughly, where somebody called Anderson sort of proposed that correlation supersedes causation. So we don't need mechanistic explanations anymore. And the scientific method is no longer useful. And instead, we should sort of trust machine learning and artificial intelligence based on large data sets. And we don't need models. So that's the implication. But the response to that, I think, is A, so if you have a model of a pandemic or of a stock market, you can ask sort of what if questions. What if I change this? What happens then? And you can't do that if you only look at the data, because you can't change the real world that easily, right? And B, I think people would say that whatever data we collect, that there's so much, we can't collect all data, right? So the choice we make is already informed somehow by some models that we have in our minds that sort of guide us in deciding what data we look at and what do we record, right? So if you talk about inflation or something, you already have some sort of model in mind of what inflation might be. So I think a modelless world is sort of not going to be very successful in science.
Just a comment. Understanding and describing are two very different things.
And predicting.
And I think the ultimate goal that you have as a scientist is really to understand what's going on. And you may have a system that is a black box in the sense that you don't know how it works, that gives you prediction or that shows that there are some patterns, but this doesn't mean that you understand what are the reason behind these patterns. And this is the level that you want to reach, I think. And for that, you have to go through this path of modeling and theory. So I think it's not the end of theory.
No, I don't think that either. But there are certain questions where you can have a debate. If you say, okay, we want to cure cancer, right? Say, so what is now the route that is most likely to succeed quickly? Is it really writing down models and equations or something of how mutations spread? Or is it really machine learning and trying to sort of, okay, based on these patient characteristics, I think that this and that therapy ought to be best for this particular patient. So I think you probably need both somehow in different circumstances and for different purposes.
Yeah. Personally, I often think that, you know, models, they can give you answers, but if they don't pose questions as well, they're bad models. So a good model is a model that answers some of the questions that you want to answer, but it also questions you, and you know, there are surprises in the model that you haven't put by hand. So these black boxes that we were talking about, they're only providing answers. They're not forcing you to question yourself and imagine something else. And I think good models in physics in particular, they've always been tremendous because they didn't only answer the initial question, but they suggested many other questions that you hadn't asked before. And that, I think, is very difficult with these black boxes, until they surprise us and and artificial general intelligence takes over. But we're not there yet.
Is there a general matrix which you can apply to all complex systems? Kind of world formula?
I don't think so.
No. No, I think I would say no.
No, me neither.
I agree. No.
Okay, we got that. Anything that you want to talk about and we haven't found the right questions?
I think we covered a lot of ground.
Yeah, we did.
That was great.
Okay. If our listeners do have more questions and want to learn more, is there somewhere they can look for information or read something? Do you have any suggestions?
At an introductory level, I don't know. Do you know?
Good. It's a very good question. Mm. So Jean-Philippe has a book on
yes,
the matrix theory.
But it's very technical.
But it's very, yeah, so that's
so I don't think it's a good fast read for...
But it's sort of... Maybe random matrix theory is not necessarily the first thing you would read about if you're interested in complex systems. Mm-hmm. You would sort of read more widely first. Mm-hmm. And then at a later stage, if you then really get interested into random matrices specifically. But then even for complex systems, there are some popular science books. They are a bit out of date, or a bit sort of, there's one by Melanie Mitchell. Doyne Farmer has written a book on chaos and economics that sort of from last year.
That's a good book for that part of the equation. I remember a book by Philip Ball.
By Philip Ball, yes. I can't remember what it's called.
Yeah.
It's not a book, but maybe more is different. It's an article that people may read. This was written by Philip Anderson that was mentioned, I think.
1972, yes. Mm-hmm. That's a very good
philosophical
kind of...
That sounds good. Yeah. I mean, it isn't a very easy subject. It's not a good starting point, as we established, but I think that's already helpful.
Yeah, I've written also a kind of introductory lecture for complex systems called the Pitfalls of Multidisciplinarity. So maybe people can have a look at that.
Okay. So we know where to start. Okay. So thank you for your time.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Our pleasure.